sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I always say it is that your objective is to lead a customer through a corridor, and there's lots of doors leading off that corridor, and you've got to shut those doors as you go through. And that's fundamentally what qualification is that you're constantly trying to make sure that you're the right fit and the customer's the right fit for the end goal, which is ultimately them buying the product and extracting value from it. Not by saying that your objective isn't to sell anything to begin with, right? And I think this is where a lot of SaaS people go wrong with qualification. It's like, they don't want to buy it. It's like, well, no, they don't even know what you do yet. So slow down a little bit.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that was Aaron Evans. Aaron's the co-founder and head of training and enablement for a new venture called Flowstate. It's a B2B sales performance consulting firm that's based in the UK. And Aaron has also been recognized as a top 20 global sales enablement influencer. Now, in today's conversation, Aaron and I dig into the topic of qualification. You know, it's a subject that gets a lot of lip service, but overall, qualification is not performed very well by sellers. Now, if I'm working with a sales team or a seller on a lost deal review, I always start the analysis with discovery and qualification because that's where most of the problems start. I mean, discovery being the other side of the coin with qualification. So we'll get into why Aaron likes his why buy analysis and how to implement this with sellers for qualification. We also dive into objection handling, and Aaron discusses how he uses the feel, felt, found technique to help surface the real question the buyer is posing with their objections and then how to answer them. So all this and much, much more. But before we get to Aaron, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Big fan of your work. Lovely to be here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's very nice of you to say. And likewise, so you're based in the UK. So tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
Sure, yeah. So I work for an organization called Global Data. It's actually the fastest growing business analytics organization on the London Stock Exchange. And my role is probably, I was going to say traditional sales enablement, but it probably isn't in my organization. But I basically am responsible for the enablement for about 500 reps globally. Mm-hmm. So that's building systems, so the operational side of it, all the way through to the delivery side of it with training, coaching. So yeah, it's like spinning plates while herding cats with 500 staff, but a lot of fun in the process.
That's I like that description. It's yeah, herding cats while spinning plates. It'd be a good variety show act.
Yeah, indeed.
So, but you've got sort of a side hustle too, or you're putting up sales training videos.
Yeah, absolutely. So I run a YouTube channel, basically trying to sort of cut through the noise of a lot of sales training and sales motivation. And I decided to just give away as many practical hints and tips that are actually usable, scalable, and ultimately going to help salespeople get better at their job. So I decided to start a YouTube channel, which has been sort of fairly successful over the last 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, you're getting some good views. So you say cutting through the noise of sales training. So what's the noise you're cutting through?
Yeah, good question. I think, look, I mean, I've been in sales enablement for about 13 years now, and obviously some of that time before was spent in sales. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I use LinkedIn as a really good kind of barometer for where sales training's at, and I find that there's a lot of white noise. And I think being a rep in sales nowadays, actually, the hardest part of the job is to discern real credible advice from sort of that kind of motivational, just show hustle and grit and just get it done.
Yeah, the macho sales, yes.
Yeah, it seems to be the only industry where you get that, right? If you were a carpenter, no one's first piece of advice would be, right, you just got to work hard. It's like, well, no, but how do I make the table? That's the bit I really care about. So,
just work hard. What, you don't need instructions.
Just get up at 5 a.m. and read all this information. Like, no, give me some practical tips, right? So I used LinkedIn as the barometer. I started posting about a year ago, during lockdown, actually, just posting all my experience and my views and my tips and hints and the stuff that I typically train in organizations that I work, either when I'm full-time or as a consultant, which has always been fairly successful. And people have responded really well to it. And hopefully it will continue.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to talk about some of that. Yeah. I think you said you started this during shutdown. My wife and I were going through. So one of our favorite diversions during lockdown was Andrew Cotter videos. You familiar with him, with his dog, Mabel and Olive?
No, I'm not.
Okay. You got to look it up. So he's a sportscaster in the UK, and he started filming these YouTube videos, like doing commentating on his dog's actions and creating sort of fake scenarios, like, you know, competitions over a bone or something. They're hilarious. But anyway, so that was – anybody listening, check out Andrew Cotter, C-O-T-T-E-R. He's becoming a big star too. So let's talk about qualification, because that's one of the things that I'm passionate about, I think. Also, people, there's a lot of noise about it, to your point, most of which is incorrect, at least in my estimation. And I think it plays such a large part in sales success. I mean, I think you would probably agree, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
I mean, I can go back, I think, through do any sort of, as I have done as a consultant, I go into companies and we look at, you know, past results, and I'll go to look at lost deal review. And Yeah, 99% of the time could trace the failure back to some failure in qualification.
Yeah, I mean, I always say it as that your objective is to lead a customer through a corridor, and there's lots of doors leading off that corridor, and you've got to shut those doors as you go through. And that's fundamentally what qualification is that you're constantly trying to make sure that you're the right fit and the customer's the right fit for the end goal, which is ultimately them buying the product and extracting value from it, right? I mean, that's fundamentally why we're there.
Yeah.
But I'll start by saying that your objective isn't to sell anything to begin with, right? And I think this is where a lot of salespeople go wrong with qualification. It's like, they don't want to buy it. It's like, well, no, they don't even know what you do yet. So slow down a little bit.
Or, to your point, they're just not a prospect.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I think, is, again, part of the issue with the way qualification is taught in many instances, is that it's the sort of refusal to believe that someone's not actually a prospect for what you have. As opposed, just because they responded to an email, they filled out a form, they've got a lead score in your system. It's like, yeah, they're not really a prospect. So yeah, you could go through and spend a lot of time selling them, but you're not going to win, or it's going to end up in a no decision. And you should be able to know this ahead of time.
Yeah, I'd argue that it's actually one of the best skills a salesperson can have, is the ability to qualify out. I think that so many reps get an emotional attachment to an opportunity or a prospect because they've got a very thin pipeline. They're desperate for a sale to come in. So they start injecting faith into their opportunities, where it's like, I'm convinced this one's going to come in. Where it's like, no, you should have qualified out this one out weeks ago. And you've wasted a load of time in that process.
But don't you see it also the other way, though, too, is that, especially in SaaS businesses, you see this insistence on, you know, you need a 5x pipeline coverage. And so it's not that their pipelines are thin, is they're dictating their sales, you know, their investment of time based on the fact they need to maintain a certain coverage ratio, which is also as dangerous as having a thin pipeline.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I think it comes down to objectives, right? I think if we look at what is considered to be the kind of early stage qualification, is someone actually wanting to see your product, right? So you've called a customer and they want to sit a demonstration. But the reality is, if I phoned my mum now and said, Mum, do you want to sit a demonstration? She probably would. There's no chance of her ever buying our product, right? But she'd probably sit down. And I guess
she's developed a hobby in data analytics, so you know now.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. I doubt it very much, but yeah, possibly. But again, I guess, like, if we're talking about really early stage qualification, right, that criteria is so critical to working out whether there's someone who is even deemed sitting down with for an hour to learn about their organization and understand their challenges. And I think it's become diluted with the SDR model as well, because SDRs, their objective isn't always to make sure that the sale's completed. Their objective is to book demonstrations for the AE. Right. They're actually two inputs that are fighting against each other, because the AE actually wants quality, right? So I find the best SDR organizations are the ones that are actually targeted on that, those leads turning into revenue as well. But then you start getting a fight because they think their AEs aren't good enough.
I gave you a good lead and you didn't close it.
Yeah, exactly. They then become incredibly critical of the AE, which is always difficult to deal with as well.
Well, but that's just the old marketing sales argument, right? Unfortunately, SDRs are really a marketing function. We've moved them into sales in many cases, and we've just taken that argument out of marketing and brought it within sales. Yeah, but the point is, SDRs aren't really trained or enabled to really qualify to do. They can do. Are they qualified to take a demo?
Yeah,
sure, and they can be better at that, and we need to do better at that. But that's, and some organizations see this expectation that, or not even expectation. Well, it's sort of an expectation. Is you look at the way they determine how they define what a sales qualified opportunity is, yeah, the SDR qualified them, and they asked them these questions. You got these answers, and I'm like, no, that's not qualified. But you look at most internal sales processes, and they define qualification as a stage, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. We've got a single stage. It's a one-time event. We've got exit criteria for it. And just based on what you were saying earlier, I think you'd probably agree with my perspective, which is that I qualify, and I want people to qualify every time they interact with the buyer. Because as the buyer goes through their process, they're evolving, they're learning, they're changing, their understanding of the problem they want to solve should be enhanced and expanded, their understanding of what the opportunities are and the options are to solve the problem should be enhanced as they go through the process. So what we qualified them on initially may not be valid a month later.
Yeah, and again, I think that qualification isn't an event, right? It's something that's constantly happening through the interactions of the salesperson, and I want to be really clear, and the organization that they're selling to, right?
Right.
Now, I think it's interesting because you've got two competing processes operating at the same time. You've got a sales process, which is very much about, turning an opportunity into contracted business. And mm-hmm. then you've got a customer's buying process, which in every single business is completely unique. And their objective is about making sure they're, hedging a bet that's going to generate ROI. And there's usually lots of people involved in that decision, or at least have a say in that decision.
Right.
And it's very difficult to align those two processes in a really neat way where both parties feel like they're going on a journey together. Now, in my experience, the sales processes, but I'd use the term guided sales process more importantly. The ones that work well are when the customer-led events are actually the ones that are denoting where you are in that sales process.
Exactly.
Not events that you're doing, right? So I always say to reps, like, open your email now, attach a proposal and send it out to every single person you know. Congratulations, you've just sent out 1,000 proposals. None of them are going to come in. What you really want is a customer turning around saying, can you please send me a proposal? And this is what I want in the proposal. Ah, that's a customer-led action.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, this brings up a broader point for, whether it's specifically enablement, sales operations, sales management, is that it's like we have to sort of come to an understanding now. We talk about how, modern sales. This is one of my pet peeves, right? People talk about modern sales. And I'll say, well, what is modern sales? Well, basically what it turns out to be is we're doing the same old shit we've always done. We're just putting a layer of technology on it, mm-hmm. on top, right? Because you look at most companies' sales processes, and I did this a couple months ago, I Googled sales processes and looked at all the hundreds of results that people put online. And it's like, oh, yeah, same process, stage-wise and so on, that I learned how to use in sales 40 years ago, mm-hmm. right? So there's nothing new here. So, but what could be new is just what you just said, is what if instead of denominating our stages by what we do, we do it by what the customer needs to get done.
100%.
Suddenly that starts making sense. That would be modern, right?
Yes and no, right? Because we create sales processes that encourage these actions out of the client, but we don't explicitly look at them as what means that the opportunity is progressing, right?
Right.
And again, I think it is a battle because the reason that we put artificial urgency on customers is not because we want the deal in. Like, if we did that part right, we'd build relationships and we'd wait for the logical time for the deal to come in. But there's external pressures on salespeople, like the number bearing down on their target, like the pressure from their manager, like, you know, the pressure from the organization and what the organization is trying to achieve. Mm-hmm. And this is where you start getting malpractice, because you take your eye off the prize, which is the fundamentals of selling is helping someone. That's what it is.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's pretty simple.
Well, so here's my definition of sales, just building on that. So, and do you have a one-line definition of sales besides just helping someone?
Well, yeah. I mean, fundamentally, I'd say it's that. It's helping someone improve. That's what it is. Whether that's an organization, a process, whatever it is you're selling.
Yeah. I mean, mine is along the same lines. It's selling is listen to understand what's the most important thing to the buyer and help them get it.
Yeah. Pretty much spot on. Yeah. I'd agree with that.
That's it. That's all we're trying to do. We're trying to listen, to ask questions, listen to understand what's the most important thing to the buyer, then help them get it. And it's not any more complicated than that.
No, I agree. I mean, I always find it interesting, and you said it before, but if you distill down sales to fundamentally what it is, it's find a problem and solve it. And if you can't solve it, you're not the right person to solve it, right? And there's this necessity, and I find it nowadays with modern selling, you know, to use that term again, there's necessity to try and inject in things that, in my opinion, are actually superfluous. Like, there's so much talk about this sort of pop psychology in sales nowadays. And I see a lot of it on LinkedIn, where people are talking about stuff that is deeply interesting, but I don't personally see it as being something that affects someone purchasing a product.
Well, give us an example.
Well, you know, you hear about, like, people saying things like, I see this a lot on LinkedIn. Here's a script that will always work. Say this, pause for 15 seconds. Once you pause, say this word here. This will disarm the client, and then they'll feel like this. It's like, no, like, you know, I get the intention. I think it's really good, and it may well work for them. That's the point, right? It may well work for them. But in the common practices of selling, which is basically the majority of people in sales are middling to low performers, right? That's the reality of sales. And our objective in sales enablement is to get those middling and low performers up to a standard where they are happy in the job, they are profitable, and they can maintain their position in the company. That's fundamentally it is, right? The next step should be to get them up to the very top, right? That's what we want to do. But realistically, it's hard to get everyone up to the very top. That's why there's only 53% of people are only hitting target every single month, right?
Well, yeah. But I mean, even to your point about, you know, getting them, that first stage you defined is, you know, you get them sort of consistently good, right, is I think the goal is just to help people become the best version of themselves. And for many people, that's never going to be the top. And that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, just the statistics work out. There's not room at the top for everybody, right?
Yeah, of course.
And that's fine. This is what I think we need to be doing as enablement, and more importantly, as sales leadership, is how do we help people? To your point precisely, is I agree with you, but a lot of the stuff that's out there on LinkedIn, it's not that it's necessarily invalid, but it might work for one person. That's fine. Yeah, I think ideas deserve an audience. But I think what we're using technology for in the wrong hands, the way it's being used, is this is how Jennifer sells. Everybody needs to sell like Jennifer, right? You need to use these three words at this point in time in the conversation. And that's not the best use of the technology. The best use of the technology is, as a coach, is to say, I understand where this person sits, is how can I help this person become the best version of themselves? How can I coach them using these technologies to become the best version of them so they feel more fulfilled? Yes, they may not be a top performer, but they're good at what they do. And this is one of the myths within sales. I wonder if, interested in what you feel about it, is because you obviously spend time on LinkedIn, is, you know, we're at the myth of the top performer. Right? Everything's about the top performer. And when you tell people to be good at something, it's like it's a pejorative. Now, you want to be good? Mm-hmm. And when did good become bad? Good is good. If I was running a sales organization, I'm going to have a few top performers, a few at the bottom. I want the rest of the people to be good at what they do and to feel fulfilled.
Yeah, I mean, tell that to any CEO, right? I bet they'd be biting your hand off. That's the point. Like, I look at the sales enablement function, I think that basically, if we can get everyone better than they were yesterday, we're doing a really good job, right? That's a great thing to have. And in conjunction with the manager, who's, in my opinion, the sole objective of a sales manager should be to make their people better than they were yesterday. But that, for me, that's the key thing. And when you put those two objectives together with sales enablement and sales management, it actually becomes a recipe for real success.
Right. But what percentage of sales managers do you think, especially these days, since the default oftentimes is to default to the metrics, right? And manage people on their metrics as opposed to really understand, you know, same thing we talked about selling. Yeah, understand, listen to understand what's most important thing to them is what coaches and managers need to do with their person that works for them. You need to listen to understand what's most important thing to them, help them achieve that.
Yeah, I find there's way too much output focus and not enough input focus.
Like, right.
You know, I think about the role of a manager, and I thought about this a lot, right? Of a sales manager, I should say more specifically. And I group it into four fundamental objectives. The first one, obviously, we spoke about is making their rep better than they were yesterday. The second one is actually translating the organizational values in a way that people actually really want to work for the company and they want to fight for the company. But then they have a responsibility at a local level to create a set of localized values where the team want to work for them and they believe in them as a leader. And right. Lastly, at some point, they should report on that
right.
when asked. Where right. do you think they spend most of their time reporting?
Yeah.
It's like, no, like 75% of the job is actually the stuff that's genuinely going to drive like real engagement, real change and real like achievement. And, you know, you know sales enablement better than anyone, right? It's like there's a battle between sales enablement and sales management in my experience where they're trying to get things simple and make sure that sales enablement aren't complicating things and meddling. But at the same time, our objective is to get everyone to a really good standard by doing the right practices.
Which is ironic because that really they should be advocating for the same things. And so to your point precisely if a sales manager is spending 75, you know, a disproportionate amount of their time, whatever the percentage is, reporting or being focused on the data inputs to the reporting. I've got to create a new category for those. I call those sales bosses. There's kind of boss to the numbers, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the other category I call sales leaders. And they're the ones that lead from the perspective of thinking, I'm only going to succeed to the extent that my people succeed. So what can I do to make my people more successful? And to your point about, you know, being 1% better every day. We have way too many sales bosses these days and not enough sales leaders.
I do feel that it's often the fault of the layers above them as well, right? And I think there's some of it sits on them. And you know, I always say that if your boss is constantly asking you for numbers, it's your CRM that's broken. It's not you that's broken, right? There should be an easy way for your CEO to click a button now and find out
right.
every single story.
Right.
Yeah, like it's not that hard. And I do have enormous amount of sympathy for sales managers because I do feel that they're not always set up for success in lots of organizations I've worked in.
I agree, 100%. I think this is, to your point about the fault layer lays above them, is, you know, sort of my, what drum I beat quite frequently these days is that, you know, in the U.S., I think the figure is we spend $20 billion a year on sales training, of which there's no breakout for management, but yeah, I'm willing to bet that at most we spend 5 to 10% of that on training and enabling sales managers.
Mm.
And so we put them in this position. We don't give them the tools. We don't train them. You know, they know nothing about performance or performance management. And this is not a personal failing. They just haven't been given this information. You know, so, yeah. And that really sort of starts at the top because they make the point is, or the decision is, you know, we're going to allocate our training budget to, yeah, generally ineffective training methodologies to train our sellers, and we're not going to enable the managers that make it all happen. So
yeah, I agree.
My thought is if we're spending 10% on, last point on that, if we're spending 10% of the $20 billion on training managers, what if we flip that ratio? What if we spent 90% of the money on enabling management, frontline managers and above, in things like performance improvement, performance management, you know, coaching, and so on, and just spent 10% on sellers? I ask people all the time, so what do you think would happen to sales if we did that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a classic case of trickle-down effect, right? And again, it even starts with things like training them on hiring, right? I mean, basic things like that. Like often they've got a team of duds that aren't right, or don't fit, or, you know, a lost souls who shouldn't really belong in sales.
Right.
And it's because they're not hired right. They don't have a spot competency. one of the most effective modules I've ever brought into any organization. And I often do it very, very early is let's get the coaching standards up to scratch with managers. Because if you can nail that early and you can get a good coaching cadence, with real data-driven coaching, where they're working on proper competency and they're getting their reps better, you'll have this enormous sort of effect where it will just trickle down the organization and the quality of all of the individual contributions just goes through the roof. It's such a basic way of looking at it. And you just, you know, it's such a blind spot for businesses. And I feel that, again, to echo your point, is that there's an enormous under appreciation and also under investment in those managers.
Oh, absolutely. And
easily solved.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it requires a real shift in mindset. So, yeah, I've talked about this on the show is, for instance, let's take an organization your size. Should you have 500 sellers, would it be unreasonable to say, wow, maybe we should have a sports psychologist on the staff, right? A performance psychologist. Because, we know psychology is a huge part of what happens performance-wise with people. Why wouldn't it make sense? You have 500 people on staff, it create one more headcount for a psychologist. Why wouldn't an organization your size, why wouldn't it make sense to have maybe specialized coaches, right? I mean, I take a lot of examples from professional soccer. They have a whole raft of specialized coaches. You know, Liverpool's got a throw-in coach, right? So why don't we have coaches, very specialized coaches who are trained performance coaches, right? Why? We know things like sleep, exercise, nutrition. You know, why don't we have life coaches? You know, in an organization your size, you're talking about additional 3 or 4 headcount. Why wouldn't we do that? And yet, no one's thinking about this. This is selling is a performance-based profession, and we don't invest in other than the sort of traditional ways, which haven't proven to be very successful, in improving performance and looking at the whole salesperson.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you look at a lot of CEOs, and well, not CEOs, it's probably not the right way of labeling it, but organizations as a whole, and they want a direct result to revenue when it comes to sales. So if you are not seen to be actually bringing some money in directly, I mean, you know, like you've been doing sales enablement long enough. I remember when sales enablement was like a luxury position, because it was like, you know, you guys, you're not carrying a number, you're not generating revenue. What right do you have to be part of the sales organization?
Right.
Maybe it's changing, right? I'm seeing a lot more specialized sales enablement as an example. I think you're getting CS sales enablement, you're getting before sale, after sale, post-sale, pre-sale sales enablement. And I think, and I can only imagine that the more sales enablement becomes important, which it is, for me, it's slowly becoming the most important role in the organization. As you can see, it's moving higher up the organization. It's getting involved in the more strategic part of the business.
Right.
It's the conduit between almost every single department in an organization. That I can only imagine that those roles will become more specified and more specialist. And ultimately, it will sit under the sales enablement function, which is where it should sit. So I have faith in that being the way forward. I just don't think we're there yet, to be honest with you. Yeah. But it's definitely a shift, right? There's definitely
more faith
a shift.
Than I have. Yeah. Well, I think it's your point. Is it has to start at the top. Is they have to look at what are the roles that can contribute to an overall performance improvement that aren't the traditional roles as we've defined them. Yeah, and just because somebody carries a title doesn't mean they know squat about coaching and all these other aspects we talked about. Yeah, and here's just another to the point about the psychologist. I mean, there's a recent survey out as part of Mental Health Awareness Month here in the United States about sellers. It was done by uncrushed.org. And you know, as of, let's say, roughly beginning of May, 75% of sellers report feeling stressed or highly stressed. The rate of, self-reports of mental health issues is, it was 40% or 42%. But we know as adults, at least in the U.S., and I imagine it might be not too dissimilar in the U.K., is fully two-thirds of adults at some point in their life are going to encounter mental health challenges. So why aren't we looking at that? 75% of sellers feel stressed or extremely stressed. It has an impact on performance. Don't we need to address that proactively? Don't we need to to say, what can we do differently? How can we teach resilience to people if that's one of the clues? How can we change how we structure? I mean, yes, we still have to perform. Not saying you're going to perform at a lower level, but yeah, we're burning people out. And it's not just COVID that was doing it, because these numbers were high even before COVID. So why don't we acknowledge that and bring this in, as I said, like a staff psychologist or whatever, people can real time can deal with some of these, get help on some of these issues that we know are affecting them both at work and at home.
I mean, sales is unique, right? You use the example of sort of relating it to sport, which I think is probably the closest sort of parallels you can draw. But I can't think of another industry where every single month you go back to zero and you've got to prove yourself again. Yeah. And what you've done prior to that has been worth absolutely nothing the day after.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, back to the carpenter thing again. Imagine building a chair and then someone kicks it to the ground to rubble and then says, build it again every single month, right? And
consider that torture.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It takes a very unique mindset to do that for a sustained period of time. And I think no one is infallible. Eventually, they're going to fall foul to that process and it's going to affect them. And I think businesses need to look at sales performance on a longer basis, I think. And they need to look at bad performance on a longer basis as well. Mm-hmm. You see too many businesses that look at 1 month as being someone, or 1 quarter as being someone's failed.
Right.
Now, what then tends to happen is a performance program starts. Well, what we should be doing in sales enablement is spotting those early signs and using it as a support mechanism, mm-hmm. versus a kind of, you know, a life raft where it's like, right, you're going to drown, right? And I think we need to spot those signs of poor performance, which might be a whole myriad of other issues, including, you know, mental health.
Yes.
And we should use it as a support function to get them back on track.
Yeah.
Looking at someone over a month or a quarter is not a sign of success. I mean, you're a football fan, right?
If it only took
one game or four games, then, you know, it wouldn't be a very long league. It takes 38 games to be successful, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds as unique in that way.
Well, I agree 100% on that. That's why I think we're starting to see some tools and some companies, like a company called Leon in the United States. It's, you know, creating this wellness predictive index, you know, for using what they call wellness intelligence for your sales teams. Because, and you're seeing a lot more about, you know, people with using wearables and mm-hmm. so on to track sleep and recovery. Because, okay, I had a conversation last week with Brian Smith, co-founders of Leon. Excuse me, was a sports science consultant to the United States Track and Field Federation. And so, you know, professional track and field athletes that represent the country. And you know, the comparison to, you know, like building up your endurance and your resistance to stress as you train, let's say, to run a marathon, what you're doing is your training program is designed through rest and recovery and workout is to help your body adapt to ever-increasing loads of stress. Mm. Yeah, so that you can run a marathon at a higher pace or whatever your race is. This is the way the mind works for sales as well. And we're completely unmindful. It's just the science exists. Mm. And if we take knowledge, you know, acknowledge that the fact it exists, and that's why I say you're seeing now more and more companies are saying, well, yeah, how's your sleep affecting? And you can track, you know, how your sleep affects your performance. You know, you got a big presentation, how to go based on, you know, you only had 2 hours of sleep, or, you know, just the cumulative effect of stress. Yeah, maybe you need to take a day off. You know, they do that in soccer, right? I mean, I'll turn the match and one is watch, you know, one of my favorite players is like, well, he's not even named in the 18 for the day. Well, because they're so tightly measured in terms of their rest and recovery that they decided, look, it was too big of a risk to have that person not performing that day.
The problem we have, right, is that if you're working for an incredibly large organization that's making billions of dollars in profit, that becomes a no-brainer. But when we look at sales, the majority of sales organizations are actually in that long tail of, you know, sure. tier C customers where, you know, if you're working for a startup, you know, it's like, the minimum is you put in 18-hour days and that's it, right? You got to work as hard as the founder. So,
I've done it 8 or 9 times, right? And I can tell you that it wouldn't make a damn bit of difference if, you know, once a month, Aaron needed to take a day off because he was working so hard, he needed to recover. because his body needed to recover, because I need Aaron to be there for the long term. And this is, you know, this is a thing that, increasingly I think we're getting data about. We understand at one level, and yet the culture is such that it's difficult to get senior leaders to sort of look at it, to the point you made earlier, and say, this is a little bit of investment now, but if we track this, yeah, I think we're going to get a payback over the long term. And it's not the CEO shouldn't, you know, they just have to make a decision on it. Someone, you know, at the CRO level or sales enablement level, someone has to put the case before them and say, we think this is going to make a huge difference. Let's experiment with it. And I think we'd find lots of people willing to experiment with it if they would make the case.
Oh yeah, I don't doubt that. I mean, look, it's really interesting you say this, because on a micro level, I see it in people's pipeline, right? Where they've missed their target 3 months in a row and they're desperate to get deals in, and you start seeing some really weird behaviors, like really, really strange behaviors. And if you get the opportunity to say, look, you're actually going to take a month off and not worrying about bringing any revenue. Your objective is actually to build some meaningful pipeline that's going to serve you for the next 6 months. And all of a sudden, that coming up for air, that getting off the hamster wheel, that, you know, removal of pressure,
right,
is where you start seeing real performance. And, you know, again, I come back to sales enablement. Like, we find there's competing pressures where we're trying to put in place best practice, we're trying to put in place the right ways of doing things, and we're trying to scale excellence. Whereas often the thing you're competing against is someone saying, I don't have time to do that. I can't do that. Because if I make a change now, it means I might not do this.
Right.
And it's that strange abductive logic that we have to fight against to make sure that we are seeing success, right? It's hard. It's very, very difficult.
Well, it is hard. I mean, think about it. You know, in the Valley these days, you know, the stat is the average tenure of a CRO is 18 months. So they're coming in, they can't even implement their program for more than like one full accounting cycle, right? I mean, if you're trying to make changes, so now you can understand why change doesn't happen, because they come in, they have sort of what they think is a system and a process that works. It's not optimal by any stretch of imagination, but hey, if I can make it last for 12 to 18 months, I might get another 12 to 18 months. And so the fear factor is, look, I can't possibly perturb anything during this period. And certainly in that space, I think that is one of the real problems, is that, yeah, people feel they just don't have time to make a change. And so we're persisting in these same behaviors that have been going on forever. Yeah. In fact, maybe worse than they were even two decades ago. And yeah, someone's got to have the courage to step up and say, yeah, we're going to break the cycle on this.
I agree.
I mean, it's all right, gosh.
We got really sidetracked. We were talking about qualification initially. We needed to qualify ourselves a little bit.
It's the way it works on this show. You got to come along for the ride, because you never know which way we're going to go. Yeah. Yeah, I spend hours preparing for each of these interviews, and if we're lucky, we use a third of the things I prepare to talk about, because, you know, it's just an interesting topic, and this is a people business. We're really fundamentally talking about people and how we help people become the best version of themselves. Yeah, I remember a quote, and I've brought this up on the show a couple times. This is from one of the Premier League teams, and they were talking about how they bring new players onto the side. And they were really specifically talking about young players, so it's people at the beginning of their careers. So in this case, you know, it could be an 18, 19-year-old, but, you know, make it the equivalent of a 21-year-old joining a sales team. And I wrote this down, because it just struck me. As they said, yeah, what we do is we spend a few months and we train the person before we train the player, right? So we help them adapt this whole idea of being a professional. What's it mean, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the lifestyle, the nutrition, the sleep, the rest, the recovery, the, you know, day-to-day routine, the discipline of showing up on training on time, all those things, which we just assume people know.
Yeah.
Right. So we bring new sellers on, we put them into the onboarding program, and we just assume they know all these basics about even, you know, how to hold a conversation with another person, right? How to connect at a human level, let alone how to develop mental resilience in the face of rejection, which they're invariably going to face.
Yeah. Right.
We do none of that. And again, these other professions that are similar to ours in the respect that that's, you know, sort of a zero-sum performance-based profession, are doing it much better than we are, and we could do better. And that's just one example. I mean, the other one is to a point you made earlier, which I think is such an important point, is that if you're hiring a number of people, this is sort of the fallacy of the onboarding programs for most companies, is they assume that everybody's learning curve is the same.
Yeah.
And they're not, right? I mean, exactly. If you think you have the perfect onboarding program and a normal human being, is going to learn, you're kidding yourself. Everybody learns at different rates. And so, not everybody gets it. I mean, I don't know. I was probably 7 or 8 months into my sales career before I finally started, the light bulb started going on about, things starting to make sense. And it was a continuous process for many years, right? As I took on bigger and bigger accounts and so on, where it just took a certain amount of time to learn. But we've certainly in the tech space now, it's like, you get X period of time, otherwise you're out of here.
Yeah, and to the counter of that, I've seen so many people who it took so long to get it right. And then when they got it right, they just shot and they were just amazing, right? They were just brilliant. In fact, one of the guys I coached at a former business won salesperson of the year the next year after being weeks away from being fired. And I remember validating that and saying, look, everything he was doing right was, everything he was doing was right apart from the deals weren't closing.
Right.
And his pipeline was under so much scrutiny. And it's a bit like, business is like the ultimate driver who's stuck behind a learner driver, but they forget that they were in that position once as well. And it's true. Like, if you're confident in your hiring process, give these people time. You have to do that. Providing you're confident in your hiring process. If you have no clue who you're hiring, then there's a strong chance you've hired someone who's not right for the job or not right for the company or they're in it for the wrong reasons. But if you're confident in that, you should support them and set them up for success. It's really simple. Be patient.
Yeah. Well, and I think to buttress what you were saying is that I know very few companies that actually have a data-based hiring approach, right? Where they say, look, we've got these sort of attributes that we're looking for that we're going to put a score onto, and our candidates need to have a certain score in order to qualify to be hired. But then what we're going to do is we're going to track those people after we hire them and find out whether we are right or not about those attributes and whether they correlate to hiring good people, right? And no one does that, or very few enterprises do that. And it's not that hard. Yeah, I've got a system I put in place at certain companies that do this, small companies. So it's not onerous. You can just do it with a Google sheet initially. But start using the data that exists. You can use your own experience to guide you so that you take some of the emotion out of hiring, right? No, this person, wow, they're really a smooth talker. Well, yeah, is that really what you're hiring for?
Yeah.
And there's no excuse at this point. The tools exist very simply to be able to track and use data to find out whether we're hiring the right people and hiring for the right things.
I'd argue that some organizations would even struggle to tell you what the competencies are they're looking for.
I don't think you have to argue that. I think that's true.
The funny thing is, right, is some of the most effective work I've done around hiring from a sales enablement point of view is actually putting in safety nets around coachability. And I think it's particularly in sales, it's such a core thing to look out for in a candidate is coachability. And if you can build out some simple questioning frameworks that give you a peek into their mind of whether they are coachable or not, it's 50% of the job done. It really is.
Yeah.
You can never trust a salesperson's numbers when they come in and say, I blasted through target last year and I'm the most successful salesperson ever. That's great. But that was selling that product in that market at that time. I'm more interested how rounded you are as a learner and as a human being to see if you can do it in this company, right? That's the key thing.
Exactly. All right. That's a great place to end it because I agree 100% on that. How well-rounded, coachability, how well-rounded they are as a human being, their values, their character. It's not what they did before. Absolutely. All right, Aaron, we'll have to kind of come back because we'll actually talk about what I prepared to talk about next time.
I'd love to.
Qualification discovery. So if people want to connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, I mean, LinkedIn, Aaron Evans. I think I'm one of very few Aaron Evanses on there. You can't miss me. I've got very long hair and a big beard. Or if not, then feel free to subscribe to my YouTube channel. It's Aaron Evans Sales Training on YouTube. And you can see the stuff I train on there.
Yeah, and I can vouch they're very well put together, very well produced, and yeah, worth the investment of your time. So check those out. All right, Aaron, thank you very much. Look forward to talking soon.
Lovely. Great to speak to you. Speak soon.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, I'm so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Aaron Evans, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this episode is over. So thank you for your help, and thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.